So today we're looking at Dhammapada verses 318 and 319, which read as follows. Avajje vajjamatino, vajje cha vajjadasino, michaditi samadana, sattagacchanti dugating. Vajjancha vajjato nyatva, avajjancha avajjato, sammaditi samadana, sattagacchanti sugating. Which means, those who perceive as blameworthy that which is not blameworthy, and who see as not blameworthy that which is blameworthy, possessing wrong view, beings go to a bad destination. Having known as being, having known the blameworthy for being blameworthy, and the not blameworthy for being not blameworthy, possessing right view, beings go to a good destination. So these verses the Buddha taught in the course of a story regarding two groups of young boys. So there were these young boys who were want to play together in the area in and around Savatthi. Savatthi being the big city near where the Buddha was living in Jetavana. And these young boys fell into two groups, though they played together as one. One group were children of people who followed the Buddha and his teachings. And so these children had learned from their parents about the Buddha's teaching and could be said to be also followers of the Buddha, having appreciated and come to follow his teachings as well. The other group of kids were followers of other religious teachers who would have been taught the doctrines of those teachers and quite possibly practiced some of them themselves. So they played together without any incident until the parents of some of the young boys who followed other religious teachers found out that they were playing together with followers of, with children who were children of followers of the Buddha. And they became quite agitated, probably because they had heard, as was going around, that the Buddha had some kind of converting magic. That all you had to do was hear what he had to say and suddenly you'd become Buddhist. Give up your old teachings, your old teachers. And so they had been warned against followers of the Buddha, and so they were scared for the well-being of their children. And so they tried to dissuade them to play from playing with these other boys, but found that that wasn't going to work. And so they said, well, you must promise to never actually go to hear the Buddha teach. You must never go into the monastery at Jetavana, at Jeta's grove. And they warned their children, they said, never ever go there. So these boys played together, and on one day they were playing near Jetavana on a hot day, and they became thirsty. And so the young boys who were followers of the Buddha, they said, well, look, there's The monks keep water out for travelers. It's a part of a thing that they do in monasteries. There'll always be water for anyone. They would keep it out. Even today in Thailand and other places, you'll find this traditional water station for anyone who comes to the monastery. They said, "Yeah, it's okay. We'll go in there and get some water." And the other boys said, "No, we can't go in there." He said, "Look, can you do this? You go into the monastery, get some water, and bring some water back for us. That'll be the way we do it." And so the other boys, they shrugged and went into the monastery, and before going to get water, they went to see the Buddha. And they went and they saw that the Buddha was, I guess, out of his kuti, maybe teaching at the time, and they went to pay respect to him before they went to get water. And he asked them what they were doing, and he said, they said, "Well, we've come to get water, and then if it's okay, we're going to bring some water out to our friends because their parents won't let them come into the monastery." And the Buddha said to them, they said, "Get water for yourselves, but tell those boys if they want water, they should come and talk to me about it." And so these boys did that, and they brought the other boys into the monastery. The young boys, they weren't, I guess, going to blindly follow what their parents forbid them to do. And they came to the Buddha, and the Buddha taught them the Dhamma. And sure enough, they became Buddhist. And they became quite interested in the Buddha's teaching, quite pleased to hear and appreciative of the Dhamma. And suddenly we had one group of boys who were all followers of the Buddha Dhamma. These boys then went home to their parents, and some of them maybe complained to their parents or spoke out to their parents saying that they no longer followed the wrong views of these other teachers. And the parents were devastated, quite upset. And understandably so, because in their view, Buddhism was an evil, corrupt teaching. It's what they had been told by their religious teachers, perhaps, or it's what the view that was being spread by in their religious group. And so they were mourning and complaining, and were overheard by other people living in the area. And now at this time, of course, in Sawati, all of throughout the city, Buddhism was becoming quite popular. Anathapindika, this famous rich man, was a Buddhist. Visakha, another famous rich woman, was Buddhist. The king was, I think, Buddhist, or very much a person who respected and looked up to the Buddha and his teachings and so on. And so when other people heard them complaining about, "Oh, our kids, my kids are. My children are no longer listening and they're no longer following our religion. They've taken up following the Buddha's teaching. Isn't that terrible?" These other people who were wise people said to them, "What, are you crazy? Do you not know what the Buddha taught? Do you not understand that it's a good thing, that this is something very special and valuable? And if you undertake these teachings, good things come." These people were suspicious, but the other people, the wise people, said, "Come, come." And they took them to see the Buddha. And the Buddha taught them the Dhamma. And he also taught them these two verses. That really, this is the truth, is that they were seeing as blameworthy what is not blameworthy, and not realizing some of the blameworthy things that they were doing and saying as being blameworthy. So the first lesson from the story is in regards to how you teach your children. What's reasonable for these parents is that it is a duty of parents to keep their children from evil, to protect them from what is evil. But it's also a duty to teach them what is evil and what is not evil. And so the problem isn't in their intention, the problem is in the parents' knowledge. And it's an example, the example of a parent and a child, but the example goes for us as well. It happens for non-Buddhists who are afraid to practice Buddhism because they have no clue that it's a valuable and useful skill, but they make it out to be some kind of a boogeyman. You know, you create this idea of us and them. They are Buddhists, while we are not Buddhist. We cannot practice that. But the other lesson from the story is this general idea of confusing reality with concepts. So when we, even as Buddhists, cling on to ideas of us and them, for example, so we won't listen to people when they criticize us or give us advice because we say, oh, you're not Buddhist, or you're not my type of Buddhism. We might cling on to ideas like meditation. We cling to Buddhism. Buddhists will cling, like everyone else, to the idea of being Buddhist, thinking that somehow that is valuable, somehow that is meaningful. Buddhist monks will cling to the idea of being a Buddhist monk, will prop themselves up as being special because they're a Buddhist monk. And meditators do this as well. So a meditator will be able to count how long they've been meditating for, maybe talking about how they've meditated for so many years. But even during a meditation course, this can come up. You might count how many hours you're practicing. Some places they make you count, today I did so many hours. And so you count that as having some sort of meaning, some sort of value. But of course, this isn't real, this isn't the truth. Buddhism is not a religion, not something you should be afraid of or think of as either belonging to it or not belonging to it. Buddhism is a training, and it's very much in tune with reality. So it relates to our experience of the things around, the world around us and the world inside of ourselves. So it's not something that relates to how many hours you've done or who you are or who you aren't. It's about the reality of your experiences. So as Buddhist meditators, the lesson we can take away is to remind ourselves that to not be like these parents, clinging on to concepts, clinging on to the idea that this is me, this is mine, this I am, even as far as our status as wearing robes or doing walking or how the minutes and hours of walking meditation and sitting meditation. The only thing that is important, that is valuable, is the present moment, our experience here and now, and how we're perceiving that experience, how we're relating to it. How are we behaving right in this moment? And this is what the Buddha's teaching at its essence is about. It's about this present moment. And it's about cultivating clarity and wisdom and purity of mind in regards to this experience right now that we are having moment by moment by moment. And learning to stay in the moment, to not get caught up in this world of concepts. You know, you can use concepts. You talk about people, you talk about being Buddhist, you talk about practicing Buddhism, you use a timer so you do walk so many hours and sit so many hours. But you don't see the meaning or value in that. There's no essence in any of that. Otherwise you can get caught up in seeing as blameless what is not blameless and not blameless what is blameless. What is blameless, and so on. For the verse, the first part of the verse is this word wajja. Now, these two verses are parallels to the earlier verses that we already looked at. It just uses a different word wajja, which really has the same sort of idea as the previous verses. But just to recap, the idea is that there is what is wajja and what is not wajja. Wajja means that which you should blame someone for, or that which you should scold someone for, or you should speak up about. Because in Buddhism, we don't just speak up about anything. We don't get caught up in criticizing, picking on people for their habits or their behaviors, or talking about worldly affairs. We only speak up when it's necessary. So wajja is something you should speak up about. If someone does something truly wrong, they should be spoken to. Blameworthy is the idea. And there's two ways that we mix this up and get it wrong and develop wrong view in regards to what is blameworthy. The first, as with the last verses, the first is that something that is good you see as bad, or something that is bad you see as good. Quite simple. And this happens, of course, outside of Buddhism, people will not see the danger or the fault in killing. People will proclaim as good hunting and fishing and sport and killing insects and mosquitoes, termites. These kinds of things are good. Killing mice, killing spiders, even killing human beings. There are, of course, many humans who don't see the fault and don't see the problem. If they can get away with it, they'll do it. This is simple ethics, simple morality, simple immorality. And likewise, people will criticize those who do good things. People who are generous, they will criticize them as being naive or being irresponsible with their wealth. People who cultivate morality and ethics, they will criticize. And people who don't drink alcohol, they will criticize. And people who practice meditation. There are many people in the world who see it as being, if not evil, they'll see it as just useless. So they'll say you're wasting your time, talk about it as being selfish, something that you do to only bring pleasure to yourself and not help the world or not bring anything good to the world, not do anything for anyone else. And then, of course, there are people who do believe that meditation is evil, meditation is the devil's work, or so on. Say it is irresponsible and a bad thing to do. But the more subtle form of making a mistake in regards to what is blameworthy is in regards to what is not neither wholesome nor unwholesome. So it's also common, even for Buddhists, to sometimes get caught up in what is unessential, what is meaningless. So again, getting caught up in the idea of wearing robes. So people who are obsessed with the idea of wearing robes, or the same idea of thinking of yourself as a meditator. I came into the meditation course. I will become enlightened just by doing that, just by committing myself to that. You know, getting caught up in what is meaningless and finding meaning in it. Also, we can blame people. We blame people for things that are not blameworthy, and so on. It's a core concept in Buddhism to get this right, to see what is blameworthy as blameworthy. And it's a way of describing purity and clarity of mind, that you can see what is not blameworthy as not blameworthy, and what is blameworthy as blameworthy. What is good as good, what is bad as bad. This is a quality of someone who has cultivated the Buddha and practiced the Buddha's teaching. The second part is in regards to the consequences. And the Buddha says, one who has right view goes to a good destination. One who has wrong view goes to a bad destination. So this good destination and bad destination. Notice the Buddha doesn't say heaven or hell. Often these words are translated as heaven or hell. Sugati, they're translated as heaven, but it literally means, su means good, gati means a place that you go, or a place that you've gone to. And it's important to note that the Buddha doesn't specify things like heaven or hell or any specific destination, because the point is not to focus on the destination. And more generally, the point of Buddhism isn't to focus on the results. It's essential in our cultivation of the Buddha's teaching that we focus on the experience itself, the practice itself, and not the results of the practice, which is confounding and difficult to appreciate for new meditators especially, who will always want to know, what am I going to get out of it and what am I getting out of it? Asking yourself, what is the benefit of it? The problem with that, there's two problems. The first is that what you get out of it is always going to be conceptual. So it may be that you practiced for a bit and you got something out of the practice. So that's good. You saw that it has benefit. What you're practicing is beneficial and good. But how do you continue to encourage yourself to practice? How do you continue to cultivate the intention, the inclination to practice? You have to imagine, you have to postulate further benefit. And so you're always imagining something. If I tell you, if you practice meditation, you'll go to heaven, which is a silly thing to say, but if I said that, then you would have to imagine heaven, and you'd have to think, oh, if I practice, I will go there. And somehow, by imagining that, you will cultivate the desire and the inclination to meditate. But you should be able to see the problem with it, with this. It's not real. It's some kind of thing that you create that you then cling to. It's not real. It's not enough to keep you going. Results will never be enough, because they'll always be imaginary. They'll always be something you conceive of. This is what I will get. I don't have it yet. And because you don't have it yet, you're just imagining. It's not real. The second problem with it is, as you should probably be able to tell, you're also living in the future. It's not only imaginary, it's also not mindful in any way whatsoever. So a person who is focused on results is never going to get the results. And the more emphasis you put on the results, the less results you will get. How do you, therefore, cultivate inclination to meditate? It seems impossible, then, to want to be mindful if you can't appreciate the benefits that it brings to you. And this verse, these two verses are good at explaining this. This is why the Buddha leaves it vague, because he says you don't have to think about results. Whatever comes from the cultivation of the Buddha's teaching, in this instance, the cultivation of right view, will always be good. Sugati. This is why he uses the word sugati. Doesn't matter where you go. Where you go is not important. It will always be good. Your destination, your future, the results will always be good. And likewise, if you are consumed by wrong view, the results will always be bad. Simple as that. And how this works, as I've talked about before, the cultivation of mindfulness, which leads to right view, leads to you seeing clearly, and seeing clearly therefore gives you a right perspective, helps you see what is blameworthy as not blameworthy, as see what is blameworthy as blameworthy, and so on. It involves clarity of mind, it involves purity of mind, and it involves freedom from clinging, freedom from aversion, freedom from stress, freedom from the clouds of delusion. It involves states of mind that are in and of themselves valuable and beneficial, peaceful, and verifiably good. As you start to cultivate mindfulness, you stop looking for some future result, and you start to be good. You stop thinking about why you would do good things and why you would avoid evil things. And you stop looking at things in terms of what result they're going to bring, and start seeing them for the good and for the right that they are, or for the evil and for the bad that they are. The distinction is very real. Blameworthy and not blameworthy are not some conceptual ideas that we just imagine or come up with, or we theorize or argue about. They are something you see for yourself, you understand and you appreciate for yourself through your application of mindfulness and through your familiarity with reality and with the present moment. And the third part of the verses is this distinction between right view and wrong view. And what's interesting here to point out is that, as we can see, the Buddha isn't saying what you should do. So normally when we think in terms of results, we ask ourselves, what should I do in order to get those results. Or you can even just, if you're not concerned about result, you say, okay, I'll put aside results, what should I do? So we give you something to do. We give you walking to do, we give you sitting to do. But as you can see from these verses, as you can see from the study of the Buddha's teaching, the doing is not the most important thing. What's most important is the seeing. And what this means is your perspective is the most important, which is why right view has such an important place in Buddhism. Our practice is not about how many steps you take, not about how many breaths you take. It's about how clear you can see the present moment and experiences as they happen. It's about the quality of your mind as you walk. With every step you take, the clarity of the mind, just to see this is the foot moving, to see it arise and cease. And when you sit, to see the stomach arise, the movement of the stomach arising and ceasing. And to start to gain the clarity that allows you to see that neither this nor this nor that, this or that or anything is worth clinging to. To see the most important truth, that happiness comes from independence, from freeing yourself from the attachment and need for things to be a certain way. Through the cultivation of mindfulness, you'll see greed, you're clinging to things so strongly. You'll see anger, your aversion to things. You'll see worry, you'll see stress, you'll see all of these states of mind, doubt, confusion, all of these things that cloud the mind and worry the mind and obsess the mind. And you'll see how they're causing you stress and suffering. You'll be present in the present moment. You'll realize suffering and the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. This is what is called right view, to see these four things, or simply to see things as they are. Because it's not theory that you have to hold on to or believe in. It's reality that you have to see for yourself. So our lessons as Buddhist meditators mainly are, on the one hand, from the story, to remember not to cling to ideas or concepts of who we are, to be focused on reality, to not think of Buddhism as a religion. You don't have to be Buddhist. You don't have to be anything. Buddhism is like a skill that you cultivate. It's a training. The Buddha talked about his teaching as a training, the training in ethics, the training in concentration, and the training in wisdom. This is the path that the Buddha taught. And the second thing is to remember, it's not about what you do, it's not about how much you do, it's about how you see, what you see, your perspective and the way you see things, and your cultivation of clarity and purity and wisdom. So that's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you for listening.